Tonight we're going to look at the ninth chapter of the book of Esther. And it goes without saying there's not much left after we read that. We just have three verses in the next chapter. But what we're going to do after we look at those three verses in the next lesson, we're going to look at the providence of God in this book from an overall standpoint. And after we've looked at the providence of God from an overall standpoint, we're going to briefly look at all the major characters again and learn some lessons from their life. Now, there's one lady that's seldom ever mentioned that I especially thought of in this lesson. That's the wife of Haman. So far as I know, Haman's wife was not killed in this great slaughter. There is no record of any women and children being killed by the Jews, so I assume she was still alive. Can you imagine a woman that has seen her husband hung, her 10 sons killed in battle, and still hung after they were killed? Talk about a woman that had a great deal of grief. I would say that she had a superabundance, because in just a very brief space of time, of a few days, she had seen her husband die and her 10 sons. So it must have been a grievous burden to bear. However, being an unsaved woman and all of that, it was more grievous, I'm sure, to bear than we might first think. Well, we got some bad names to try to pronounce tonight, and I'll do what I can with them. They're the sons of Haman, and there are a few other names that are not so easy to say either. We're going to start now in the 9th chapter, and the first 16 verses concern the day that has been appointed for the slaughter of the Israelites. There are really 2 edicts in force, and we'll say more about those after we read this first verse. Now in the 12th month, that is the month Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's commandment and his decree drew near to be put into execution, in the day that the enemies of the Jews hoped to have power over them, though it was turned to the contrary, that the Jews had rule over them that hated them. Well, it was drawing near to the time of this day of the great decisive battle. There were 2 edicts in force, as I mentioned there a moment ago. There was one bearing the date of the 13th of the first month. That was the one that Haman got passed back in chapter 3 and verse 12. Now that edict said that all of the Jews would be killed here in this month of Adar. Then there was another edict that had the date on it of the 23rd of the third month. That was back in chapter 8 and verse 9. And it, of course, was put into force by Esther and Mordecai. And this second edict, or decree, allowed the Jews to defend themselves against their enemies. Now, the funny thing is that during these months that passed from the time of the first edict all the way until the 12th month, it doesn't seem that any Jews left any of the provinces of Persia. Ordinarily, if someone were to pass an edict and say, now look, about 9 or 10 months from this time, we're going to kill all you Jews, some rather faint-hearted fellows would have begun to say to themselves, well, I'll tell you what, we're going to make ourselves scarce in the next few months, and they won't be able to find us. We'll move so far that nobody will even know where we are. But if anything like that happened, there's no record in the Bible. Evidently, most all of them had stayed there in the Persian Empire. I don't know why. Perhaps the providence of God was working there, though there's no definite proof of it. That's probably what was happening. Well, because there are quite a number of them in Shushan, as well as the other provinces, they form a confederacy there in verse 2. The Jews gathered themselves together in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, to lay hands on such as sought their hurt. and no man could withstand them, for the fear of them fell upon all people. You'll note that the Jews are not going to attack anybody but the people that would do them hurt, as verse 2 said. So if a fellow didn't attack the Jew, there was no harm that came to him. It was something that was done to the enemies of the Jews, to those that had assaulted them with the intent of taking their life and their possessions. But you note here that the people was fearful of them. After all, Mordecai has been advanced, and the queen is a Jew, and Haman is dead. So there was a lot of things there to make people fearful and afraid, come to think about it. I remember how back in the book of Joshua, chapter 2, and I believe it's verse 9, and chapter 5, and verse 1, the people in the land of Canaan were afraid of the Israelites. They heard that God was with them, and that they would be overthrown. So it would seem that the people in the Persian Empire had a fearful heart as well. They feared because the queen was a Jew. They feared because the chief minister of state was also a Jew. And they had heard about what had happened to Haman. So I'm sure that a lot of fellows that might have first thought about attacking the Jews probably postponed that matter from the way that reads there. However, there were some that didn't do that, like the sons of Haman. I'm sure they felt like that they needed to avenge the death of their father, especially on this Mordecai and on this queen that was Esther and anybody else that sided with them. So I can just imagine that a lot of things were happening throughout this 127 provinces. A lot of people said, well, now we've already heard that old Haman got himself hanged because of these Jews, and we're not so sure we want to do battle with them, because it just might not turn out too well with us either. And then there's a very important statement in verse 3. It would seem that the rulers of the provinces, as well as the officers of state there, helped the Jews. Now, what all would that involve? Well, it could be that these Persian rulers, they were primarily responsible for gathering the standing armies of the empire. They allowed the royal army of the king to fight in defense of the Jews. That's about what I make out of this third verse. And all the rulers of the provinces and the lieutenants and the deputies and officers of the king helped the Jews. Well, about the only way I know that they could help them in a time of battle would be to gird on the sword and go out and fight in their defense. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but it sounds a little bit like that to me. Because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them. They'd already heard about how old Haman had got himself in trouble by trying to do battle with this man Mordecai, and they're just not too anxious to tangle with him, doesn't sound to me like. Now you note how that Mordecai was highly exalted there and the chief minister of state in verse 4. For Mordecai was great in the king's house. I would say second to the king. And his fame went out throughout all the provinces. Not only did they know about Xerxes, the king of Persia, they knew about the chief of state. His name was Mordecai, and he was a Jew. And they knew about him all the way from Ethiopia to India. For this man, Mordecai, waxed greater and greater. And no doubt God was giving him this political promotion. And no doubt the king felt like that he was qualified and therefore was promoting him too. Now there's a great slaughter that takes place beginning here at verse 5 down through verse 10, and I believe I shall just read it all and then go back and look briefly at what's said there. Thus the Jews smote all their enemies with the stroke of the sword and slaughter and destruction and did what they would unto those that hated them. And in Shushan, the palace, the Jews slew and destroyed 500 men. Mark the word men there. Don't miss that. Parshandatha and Delphon and Aspatha and Porathea and Adalai and Aradatha and Parmastha and Arisaya and Aridea and Var-Japheth, the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedathan, the enemy of the Jews, slew they, but on the spoil laid they not their hand. Well, we have seen there how that destruction has started out. The funny thing that I note is that there were 500 men killed there in the palace of Shushan. Now, among these were the sons of Haman, 10 sons altogether. There were a lot more than just the sons of Haman to make up that figure there of 500. So evidently there were a lot of enemies of the Jews right there in the palace. In other words, the enemy was right there at the door of Esther and Mordecai. Now let's think about whether or not it would be right for the Persian soldiers to fight in defense of Mordecai and Esther. Definitely so in their case, because they're ministers of state, one of them, and the other one's a queen. So it was the duty there of the people of the Persian Empire, especially the army, to protect the chief minister of state and also to protect the queen. So I would say that you had Persian soldiers here fighting as well as Jews. That would account for the great number of people that were being killed at this time. So 500 men died. It didn't say anything about any women, though, did it? Well, now, the decree of the king back over there in the 8th chapter said you can kill men and women and little ones and take possessions. But the Jews only killed the men that posed a danger, just killed the soldiers, as it were. They did not kill the women. They did not kill the children. So they were very humane. They obeyed the Geneva Conference, we might say. They certainly did live up to the good policies of war because they had right to do more than what they did. And the ones that they killed with the sword and that they slaughtered were their enemies and those that hated them. Now, one of the questions that I sent out to the members of the forum today is really answered in this verse. That question was, is there such a thing as a just war that may be fought? Well, the answer is yes. Look at that verse. Because these Jews were fighting a just war. Their life was at stake. And they had to defend their families and their possessions. So there is such a thing as a just war. I'm not saying that all war is just. Please don't misunderstand me. But I'm saying there is such a thing as a defensive war that is justified and is God-honoring. Now, about an offensive war, in some cases that might be permissible too. But it would only be if your country was in danger. That would be the reason that I would say they would be justified if something like that happened. So they didn't kill any of the women. They didn't kill any of the children. They didn't even take any spoil, though that same decree would allow them to have done that back in chapter 8, verse 11. They didn't take any spoil at all. I want to show you a few things. Look at the latter part of verse 10. But on the spoil laid they not their hand. Then look at verse 15. We're getting ahead. But on the prey they laid not their hand. Then look at verse 16. But they laid not their hands on the prey. Now, they had the right to take the possessions of their enemies. And remember that that's what Haman intended to do. He intended to kill the Jews and take all of their possessions. But now here was a people that did not do all they had the right to do. You know, sometimes it may be legally right to do something and morally wrong. Now, why would it have been morally wrong for them to take their possessions? That's what they would have done to the Jews if they had killed them. Well, what about the children and the wife? What are they going to eat? Where are they going to live, see? The man's dead. What are they going to do? Say, well, they go down to the welfare office. They didn't have one in that day. Well, they go down to the king and try to get some relief. Well, they probably wouldn't have got it. You had too many fellows probably wanting relief in that day. So these people were thinking about the little ones, they were thinking about the wives back at home that had lost their husbands. So they didn't take away their possessions. And they didn't kill the women. They didn't kill the children. And I'd say that's pretty good warfare there. A lot of times when you make war on women and children, you'll live to regret it. because that will make the enemy so mad until you'll never get them to stop fighting. They'll fight to the last man when you start killing their women and their children. There's no surrender when once you start something like that. So they abided by what we might call the good rules of war. If indeed there are any good rules of war, I'd say these are the rules. Well, there's been a lot of slaughter take place. They haven't taken anything, though, from the widows and from the children. Now, the word comes to the king, and he tells the queen there in verse 11 and 12. On that day, the number of those that were slain in Shushan, the palace, was brought before the king. Some messenger came in and said, 500 men have been killed here in the palace of Shushan. And the king said unto Esther the queen, the Jews have slain and destroyed 500 men in Shushan, the palace, and the 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? As if to say, well, if they've killed that many here, you know, how many have died in that 127 provinces? And it shall be granted. Rather, now what is thy petition? And it shall be granted thee. Or what is thy request further? And it shall be done. As if to say, if you're not satisfied with the blood of 500 men, then we'll give you 1,000. Just as many as you want. Tell me. Whatever you want. We're going to go ahead and do it. We're going to grant your petition. Somebody might have said, well, if I was in the place of Esther, I said, go out there and kill all the women and the children and take away all their possessions and give it all to me. Well, she didn't ask for that, but she did ask for another day for the Jews to defend themselves, because evidently not all of their enemies had been put to the sword. But that other day was granted only there in the palace of Shushan. And so it was not another day to butcher their enemies, as one liberal commentator said that I read today. It was another day to defend themselves against the assaults of their enemies that evidently had not yet ceased in the city. I suppose those same messengers probably said it had been 500 men killed, and the people are still in an uproar. There's street fighting going on all over the place, and there's no end in sight of the battle. That was probably known to Esther, so she said, give us another day to defend our cause against our enemies. And furthermore, she wanted the sons of Haman hung. You say, well, why bother to hang them? They're already dead. Well, for our public disgrace and to put fear into the enemies of the Jews. Then said Esther, if it please the king, let it be granted to the Jews which are in Shushan to do tomorrow also according unto this day's decree, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged upon the gallows. That must have been an awful spectacle. 10 dead men, probably already butchered and cut up with the sword, hanging up there on the gallows in the main part of Shushan, probably on the main street of town. What a gory sight it must have been. You can imagine that it put fear into the bones and the hearts of those enemies of the Jews. They may have said to themselves, you see those sons of Haman up there? Old Haman got hung. Now his sons have been hung. And if we fight the Jews, we'll be on that gallows next. I'll tell you what, the fear of punishment has stopped a lot of violence in this world. And one of the reasons why we have so much violence in our land today is because there is no fear of punishment in the heart of criminals. And that can be international war criminals, or it can be people that would commit crimes in our own county, our state. I totally approved of what our president did in Libya. I would furthermore approve of more airstrikes against that country that has set out to destroy us as a people. You know, a lot of people don't understand what's going on concerning the United States in Libya. Well, let me tell you what. All of those people in Libya are Muslims. And the Muslim religion says that everybody that don't belong to our religion is an infidel. That means that to them, every Christian in the world is an infidel. Their religion further teaches, slay the infidel. So their religion basically teaches that if you go out and try to proselyte an individual, and they don't submit to your religion, you're to take the sword and kill them. Well, you see, they look upon the United States of America as a Christian nation. All infidels. So that's why Mr. Gaddafi got on national television and said, any member of our country that kills an American anywhere in the world is sure to go to heaven. Sounds a lot like the kamikazes in the time when they told those pilots over there during the Second World War, said if you'll blow up an American ship or you'll shoot down an American airplane, even though you get yourself killed in the process, you'll go straight to paradise. Well, the same philosophy is being taught by the Libyans, and it's being taught to them by Gaddafi and other leaders over there. So what their goal is the destruction of this country. People don't realize what's going on. So it's a matter of whether or not we want to defend ourselves or whether or not we want to be plucked off one at a time. Well, my answer is very simple. If they're going to get us one way or the other, then get them first. That's what the Jews did here. And I certainly believe there is such a thing as a just war, a war in defense of your own life and property. And so I definitely did approve of that attack, and I would have approved of it had it come much sooner. My only regret is that it didn't come much sooner. You just can't always be browbeat. You can't just always be killed and never retaliate as a country. If there is no fear on the part of the enemies of a country, then they'll invade and they'll do this damage, you see. But I'll tell you what, when they walked up and down the street there, all those little fellows were hanging out there on that old gallows. Didn't look too good to them. They said, now there's what's going to happen to us if we don't leave these Jews alone, you see. Fear of punishment. That's what stopped it. And it took another day of it in Shushan to get all the politics straightened out, as it were. Well, let's go on and look at the 14th verse. I don't want to give a patriotic lecture here, but I definitely do believe what I just said. And the king commanded it so to be done. See, well, he must have been henpecked. No, he'd promised the queen that he's going to do what she said. Said, well, he must have had at least chicken house ways. Well, maybe he did, I don't know, but he's doing exactly what his wife told him. But he promised her that he would, and he's kept his word. So he's at least a man of his word, give him credit for that. And the decree was given at Shushan, and they hang Haman's 10 sons. And then there are more Jews that will kill. For the Jews that were in Shushan gathered themselves together on the 14th day, also of the month of Adar, and slew 300 men at Shushan. But on the prey they laid not their hand. They're still abiding by the good rules of warfare. They will not harm women and children. They will not even take possession. Somebody said, well, now, says all of these 300 men were killed. That made 800 in the palace. That's right. Well, how many Jews were killed? I don't know, but I'm sure some of them were. Because you don't go out and fight a battle without somebody on both sides getting killed. It just lists the number here of those that were killed by the Jews. I'm sure some Jews died. It doesn't say that, but there's no such thing as a warfare with hundreds of people dying just on one side. Now, I grant in the Battle of New Orleans, most all the losses were on one side, and probably a lot of them were here on the side of the enemies of the Jews, but I would venture to say some Jews probably also died. One of these liberal commentators made another statement today that irked me a little bit, because he said, all these thousands of people died, not one single Jew died. Where did the Bible say that no Jews died? It didn't say that. It just lists the number of those that the Jews killed. Of course, there's probably some Jews killed. It didn't say there were, but it didn't make any difference. It means they probably were if you look at the overall thrust of what's said here. Now the Jews say, and I don't know whether we could prove this or not, that nearly all the people that they killed throughout these provinces were the descendants of Amalek. Well, now the prophecy in Exodus 17 and 14, God said, I'll put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. If that's true, he did right here. Probably killed almost a whole race of people there. Because after all, they intended to kill all Jews, didn't they? What was the difference? And so there was quite a slaughter throughout all the provinces, as we're going to see. But the other Jews that were in the king's provinces gathered themselves together and stood for their lives and had rest from their enemies and slew of their foes 75,000, but they laid not their hands on the prey. Now, these liberal Bible expositors, they amaze me sometimes. They quote all historians and say, well, there's just no way that many people could be killed there in 2 days' time. Now, wait a minute. Let's stop and use our head. I don't know what the total population of that 127 provinces was, but I know one thing, it went all the way from Ethiopia to India. That's a big territory. And I would estimate, as another scholar has, that there was probably 100 million people living in all of that territory at that time. I would also estimate that there could have been 2,000 to 3,000 Jews in all of those provinces. All right, assuming that there were, say, 3 million Jews, compared to that 100 million that probably lived throughout the various provinces there. There would have been no difficulty for 3 million Jews to have raised an army of 500,000. And if so, they easily could have killed 75,000 in battle. Really, those statistics are not hard to believe when you think about from Ethiopia all the way to India. And 800 there in Shushan, where probably 500,000 to 1 million people live, that's not a staggering figure, not even by today's modern warfare would it be staggering. So I don't know why the critics have such a problem there. It really makes a lot of sense to me. I think it's just the fact that they just don't want to believe what the Bible said. That's all wrong with them. Well, they seem to rejoice in their great deliverance there in verse 17 to 19. And then they're going to institute a feast that they still keep until this very day. Well, let's go on now and look at these verses quickly. But on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th day of the same, rested day, and made it a day of feasting and gladness. Now, this is the Jews in the provinces that are not in Shushan. But the Jews that were at Shushan assembled together on the 13th day thereof, and on the 14th day thereof, and on the 15th day of the same, they rested and made it a day of feasting and gladness. Now, they were a day late because they had 2 days slaughter. The others just had one. That's why how it comes about. Therefore, the Jews of the villages, meaning the provinces again, that dwelt in the unwalled towns, made the 14th day of the month of Adar a day of gladness and feasting, and a good day of sending portions one to another. We might say that would be a lot like our American Thanksgiving Day. That's about the nearest that I would know. However, it did not come in November. It came somewhere between February and March, according to our calendar, but it was different according to the Jewish calendar that's listed here. Well, we go on then to see how that there was the institution of the Feast of Purim. Purim is one of the famous feasts of the Jews, still celebrated till this day. And I would sometime that I could find a Jewish family somewhere that let me come and just watch them have this feast, as well as the Passover and a few others that I'd like to go and just see how they do, even to this remote day. It would be very interesting to me. But here's how it all began. The Feast of Purim is instituted right here. And it was not really a divine institution, but it was a human institution. But it has been preserved by the Jewish people. It's like the Thanksgiving Day in our country. It's not a command of God, but it's something that we pass down from generation to generation. Well, that's pretty much what this was. And Mordecai wrote these things, and sent letters unto all the Jews that were in all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus, both nigh and far, to establish this among them, that they should keep the 14th day of the month Adar, and the 15th day of the same yearly. It would be an annual feast. It would be on the 14th and on the 15th, taking in there the 2 days. As the days wherein the Jews rested from their enemies, and the month which was turned unto them for sorrow to joy, and from mourning into good day, into a good day, that they should make them days of feasting and joy, and of sending portions one to another, and gifts to the poor. And of course, the Jews do not hesitate to carry out the instructions here of Mordecai, as we see. And the Jews undertook to do as they had begun, and as Mordecai had written unto them, because Haman the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had devised against the Jews to destroy them, and had cast Pur, that is the lot, to consume them and to destroy them. Now let's stop right there and look at that. You remember how that Haman called in, these magicians or astrologers, whatever you want to call them, and had them to cast lots. We'd be like shooting dice, we'd say today. And to try to figure out which month out of the year and which day of the month would be the best time to kill all these Jews. And the word P-U-R there, which is usually pronounced poor, it has three different pronunciations. If you don't like mine, you can take the other two. There's about three of them. It means the lot. It's a Persian word. It means the lot. So because there were lots cast to determine what would be a good day to kill the Jews, and instead of that turning out to be the time of their slaughter, it was the time of their preservation. And instead of time of great sorrow, it was made an annual Thanksgiving day in their behalf. And so it was really a remarkable thing that happened there. But when Esther came before the king, he commanded by letters that his wicked device, which he devised against the Jews, should return upon his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. Wherefore they call these days Purim, after the name of Pur. Therefore, for all the words of this letter, and of that which they had seen concerning this matter, and which had come unto them, the Jews ordained and took upon them and upon their seed and upon all such as joined themselves to them. That means proselytes had to keep this. Gentile proselytes. That's the ones joined themselves to them. So as it should not fail that they would keep these 2 days according to their writing and according to their appointed time every year. And they've done just that. And that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, every family, every province, and every city. And that these days of Purim should not fail from among the Jews, nor the memorial of them perish from their seed. Then Esther the queen, the daughter of Abihail, and Mordecai the Jew, wrote with all authority to confirm this second letter of Purim. And he sent the letters unto all the Jews to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus with words of peace and truth. Good greetings, wasn't it? To confirm those days of Purim in their times appointed according as Mordecai the Jew and Esther the queen had enjoined them, and as they had decreed for themselves and for their seed, the matters of the fasting and their crying. You'll note that this was for the Jews and not for the Gentiles, unless they became proselytes. Then the Gentiles would observe it. And the decree of Esther confirmed these matters of Purim, and it was written in the book. That is, here in this book of Esther. As well as perhaps written the books there of the kingdoms of Persia, the chronicles of the king and all of that. I was somewhat curious today about this feast and wondered how that the modern Jews celebrate it. Well, actually, there's been a change about it. Most of the time, during these 2 days, they read the book of Esther. They gather the family in and they read the book of Esther. And if they have a synagogue, which most of them do in most parts of the world, then they gather in the synagogue on these 2 days and the rabbi will read the book of Esther during these 2 days. Now, one of the remarkable things is that whenever they say the names of the sons of Haman, they must say it with one breath. That's a rule among the Jews. But whenever the very name of Haman is mentioned, there's an awful roar that goes up from the assembly. They make a terrible noise. Sometimes the little boys have got little poles with bells on them that they ring. And sometimes the men and women will stomp the floor with their feet because they didn't like Haman, this enemy of their people. Now, originally, when they first started to do this for a number of years, they had a three-day feast before the two-day, they had a three-day fast before the two-day feast. I'll get it right after a while. And I suppose after a fellow would fast 3 days, he'd probably be ready for a two-day feast. I don't know. Anyway, that's the way they did. Now, why did they do that? Because Esther went 3 days, during the time of that feast with the king. And so they fasted during that time. But she fasted 3 days also, if you remember. Then she had that feast there for 2 days. So it seems like there's a little parallel there of some kind. So anyway, because she fasted with her maidens 3 days, they would fast 3 days. Then they would feast 2 days because of this great deliverance of their people from Haman and his son. So that was a feast of Purim. It's still celebrated until this day. It comes usually about March, and it has to do with the book of Esther. And that's what it's all about. Well, I hope you've learned a little something tonight about the Jewish people.